Okay, I don't know where to begin, but let me begin with a prosaic question. How did you get started in writing?
I began writing when I was 13 because I liked to read and I was very good in English composition and I thought it would be an easy way to make a living. So 10 years later I sold my first story. And I just got into it because I wanted to write. There was nothing else apparently that I really wanted to do, and I stuck right with it.
Where did you sell your first story to?
To Astounding Stories.
And it was published.
Campbell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I sold him the first two.
And then how did your career develop?
Well, I kept on writing science fiction. And gradually, as I learned to write better stories, I sold more stories, and then I had family responsibilities, and I couldn't make enough money writing science. But the science fiction, I was not prolific enough, and the market was not big enough, and they didn't pay enough money. So I had to branch out into murder mysteries, which I greatly enjoyed writing. And a friend of mine who was at the Martindale bookstore in Beverly Hills in those days, Harry Weplow, saw to it that...
How do I spell that?
Pardon?
Weplow, how has that spelled?
W-E-P-P-L-O. saw to it that a copy of the book went into the stack of thrillers that Howard Hawks bought every week or so. And he liked the dialogue. They rang up my agent and he said, I'd like to see Mr. Brackett. And my agent said, it's Miss Brackett. And he sort of gulped and said, well, send her over anyway. And apparently swallowed whatever prejudices he had and hired me to work on The Big Sleep. And that's that was how that began. And then... Well, it was not exactly my first film. I had just finished A 10-Day Wonder at Republic, which was my very first one.
Which was?
Which was called The Vampire's Ghost.
Now, the William Castle film, where did that come?
That came at Columbia. That was after I was had finished. Hawks put me under contract. And then he and it was to HF Productions, Charlie Feldman. He was partners of Feldman in this particular effort. And 2.5 years later, they dissolved the company for tax purposes, and I got dissolved along with it. And so I went over to Columbia, and I did the that crime doctor, the William Castle thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did a Whistler. Everybody loved the crime doctor, and did a Whistler, which nobody liked, and so that was the end. You know, that was the end of that for a while. And then of course Hollywood went in the middle of 500 a week. He couldn't get a job. And so I didn't work in the films quite a long time. I went back to writing fiction. And so I married Ed at the end of 1946, and eventually we moved back here. And we just wrote science fiction for, he wrote comics and science fiction, and I wrote science fiction because I didn't have the skill to write comics. And then in 57, out of a clear blue sky, Howard Hawks got in touch with me again and asked if I'd like to come out and work on another film. And I said, well, naturally, sure I would. So we went back out to the coast, and I went into my agent's office to sign the contract, and he said, just sit down, I have something else to do, I'll be back in a minute. So I sat down beside the desk, and I don't read other people's correspondence, but there was a big fat contract lying there, and I saw a big title on it, and no, didn't read any names or anything, and it said, where was it now? El Paz El Red. And I said, well, some fortunate writer is going to do a Western called El Paz El Red. Turned out the fortunate writer was me. I'd never done a Western in my life before. I supposed I'd be another one like The Big Sleep, you know. So that turned out to be real bravo. And so...
But you won the... I can't remember. Is it the Silver Spur Award or the...
Right,
yes.
There. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Now, what was that for?
That was for a novel called Follow the Free Wind, which was based on the life of James P. Beckwith, a mountain man. And that was a heartbreaker because it won the award for the best Western novel of the year. All the critics, you know, got marvelous reviews. The thing fell dead in hardcovers. We papered the town with it. You know, everybody, every conceivable actor, from Sidney Poitier, everybody who could have played the part, and they all said, oh, it's great, it's marvelous, it's wonderful, you know, we love it, but it would cost too much, so we can't do it. We just simply could not drum up any interest. And just recently, about a year and a half ago, Valentine picked it up and republished it in paperback. And the entire edition sold out, and they're going to bring it out again. But we still haven't been able to sell it to the... And we've tried to sell it to television. Somehow everybody says, oh, you know, you can't do that, or you can't do this, and I don't know. So anyhow, I'm happy with my spur.
You would think that a young director or could do it.
Its day will come. You see, it's an awkward, it's an offbeat story. And Beckworth was a very offbeat character. And I tried to stick very close to what I felt was the real Beckworth.
How much research did you do?
Oh, I did. I could, you know, I've got a bibliography in the back that long. And I bought all of Professor Loy's books on the Crow Indians and read, you know, the Crow texts, and which I quoted from, and tried to get the hang of the language, which has a very curious construction. It's quite beautiful. And of course, Beckworth lived so long and did so many things. Actually, what happened, I think, was that I first got a contract with Lippincott for the book. And they said, we want to put this out as a young people's book. So keep it within X limits, you know, and leave out too much of the, you know, the sex and stuff. So then, at the very last minute, after I'd had the outline okayed and they had paid me the advance, and then they decided at the last minute to turn it down. So then Doubleday took it. Now, what I ought to have done, which I didn't do, they put it out. Doubleday put it out as a Double D Western. What I ought to have done then, and did not have wit enough to do, was to take it and rewrite it and make it about twice as long. Make a big book out of it, but much more of the life, you know, of Beckworth's life into it. And I think then it might have had the impact. But as it was coming out as a colophon Western and 60,000 word length, I think was against it. I believe that was what really happened, because I had envisioned a much larger book when I began.
Do you think that you were before your time? I mean, if you had been born later, like if you were 20 today or 25 today, receptive today, or not?
I don't think so. I've often been really quite happy that I started out when I did, because it was a funny thing back then in the 30s. You know, I began reading science fiction, of course. But my whole world, my entire world, changed when I was given the Warlord of Mars at the age of 8. I got onto Edgar Rice Burroughs, you know, and the curtain went up, and there was a universe and stars and comets and whatnot, and I was never the same afterwards. But the fantasy world in those days, the science fiction world, was such a small one, and there were so few of us working in it. And I've been asked, just recently, out, and I was at a seminar out there in California this spring, and they said, how did you feel about bucking all the masculine prejudice, you know, this totally masculine field? And I said, well, I never thought anything about it. In the first place, you know, I was just me. Sex never entered into it one way or the other. I wanted to write science fiction, and that's where you wrote, you know, the only place you could do it. And I said, there was absolutely no prejudice.
You mean in the field there wasn't?
No. Absolutely none. I said we were just such a small group of nuts. Everybody thought we were crazy, and you went around hiding these things under your coat, you know, so nobody would see the cover, and you hardly dared to admit that you wrote the stuff. people thought, you know, they really considered you were out of your skull, you know, to waste your time on this stupid kid stuff. And they just welcomed me with open arms. Here was a fellow nut, you know, and we could meet and we could talk about the worm Ouroboros and the great wars of the Ike and all this stuff, and we spoke the same language, and it was wonderful. And the editors all told me to write better stories, but they never criticized my sex one way or the other. I got a few letters in the letter columns when my very first stories appeared that women can't write and rank science fiction, but after I learned to write better stories, then I didn't get those letters any longer. They weren't complaining about the sex, they were complaining about the quality of the story.
Are you happy that today it is accepted, science fiction is more accepted, or?
Oh yes, I think it's fine for the market, but what I was going to say was, I think it would have been much more difficult for me to break into the market now than it was then, because I sold stories then that had no business to have been sold. You know, for half a cent a word on publication if you can catch them. But I had a training ground. I had the pulps. I had, and it was a great place to learn. And writers were more, you know, they helped each other. Henry Kuttner was absolutely wonderful to me. He read my stories and told me everything that was wrong.
How do I spell his name?
Kuttner, Kuttner. He was just wonderful to me, and Ray Bradbury and I got to be such good friends, and we tossed ideas and tossed stories back and forth and criticized them, and you know, it seems to be more cut and dried now, and I think you have to be a better writer now to break in, and I wasn't too good a writer. I was very poor on construction. If I hit it right first jump, and I could go right through and it was fine, but if I never knew where I was going when I started. And I would write myself into a box canyon and then I wouldn't be able to get out again, which wasn't too good. And I had all, of course everybody was writing in a more lurid style in those days, but everything seems to be, to me these days, more literary and more intellectual and more academic. But to me, just now I'm speaking only for myself, understand, most of the stories to me lack that tremendous vitality that was what caught me in the beginning, the tremendous adventures and the tremendous ideas and the tremendous concepts of what could be and what might be. And of course, since then, so many things have caught up with us, like atomic power and the space program, and which has become an actuality. But in those days, it was all just, you know, just raw concept and idea, and people with tremendous enthusiasms writing these tremendous stories, you know, that streaked all over the galaxy and into other galaxies. And the field just lacks it today, to me. I mean, everybody's more inward-turning and writing sociological stories, and I'm not worried about pornography much one way or the other, but I get a little bored with some of it, and, you know.
So do you think this is true of science fiction films, or haven't they improved on the genre?
I haven't seen too many of the recent ones.
Well, you've seen 2001, haven't you? Or would you call it a science fiction film?
I have to admit I walked out on that.
Oh, really?
I
because it didn't have any vitality?
Well, I considered it rather foolish. And the opening sequence I thought was magnificent. But all that stuff on the, you know, the shuttle going up was, well, all right, you know, you do it on a plane, but you do it in a weightless state, and the things have to be, the dinners have to be weighted down. I don't know. To me, this isn't great thinking, and computer was. I'm sorry. Anyway, it was just not my bag. Let's say
no,
now.
Please
this is
please
no.
Please be frank.
I'm not criticizing the film, or it was just my personal
reaction. Of course
reaction.
You are, but that's all right. You know? I mean, you're allowed. What is your favorite? What are your favorite science fiction films?
I'm trying to think now. The War of the Worlds.
How about Them?
Them. I like.
And how about
Don
Siegel's film? What's the name of it? With Kevin McCarthy, where the I can't remember the name. These things took over the people. Oh,
The Body Snatchers.
Yeah, Body Snatchers.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Body Snatchers.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, that's it. That's the name.
Yeah.
Of it.
Yes, that
you have
was
any
that
reaction
was fine.
To that?
That was splendid. The Time Machine. The one with Walter Pidgeon, all about the Krell and the ancient civilization. All the marvelous scenes of the evil that stalked them that nobody ever saw until it got into the force beam. Edmund, come out here. You have to. He has the memory for the titles.
We'll fill that in, you know.
It's sort of almost based on Prospero and his daughter Miranda.
Oh yeah, it was. In fact, it was. Based on Shakespeare. Are we terrible?
Forbidden Planet. Forbidden
yes,
Planet.
Yes, of course. Of course.
Forbidden Planet and Rocket Ship XM. Which, with the exception of that one idiot business that they start off for one place and then everything goes crazy and they end up in another place when they could just as well have started for that place in the beginning, I thought was a beautiful film. And the fans all hated it. And I liked the fact that that uncompromising ending, they're going to crash and there isn't any hope for them and that's it.
So in a sense, you're not rebelling against the pessimism of the modern science fiction film.
Well, I get a little bored with pessimism, too, for one very big reason. Apart from science fiction, I am a tremendous ancient history buff. I have been since I was exposed to the ancient world in school when I was a kid, very young kid. Breasted's great book, if you remember. And this world has always been such a place of, my God, strife, bloodshed, sure. Pestilence, famine. It's turned turtle 3 or 4 times just on its own. Climates have changed. Entire species have been wiped out. Tamerlane slaughtered his 70,000 at Isfahan. The Crusaders slaughtered their 70,000 at Jerusalem. It's a dreadful world in many ways. But it always has been. It's also a perfectly marvelous world. And I love it. And I'll never live long enough to see all that I want to see of it. And I don't have this pessimism for, everything's terrible and mankind's all gone to pot I don't have the paranoid view of the world that some of these writers seem to have, which they're perfectly welcome to, and you know it's theirs and I wish them joy of it, but mm-hmm. They seem to feel that everybody's against them.
How did you view in light of this? Tell me about your experience working on The Long Goodbye and how you viewed that and how it perhaps changed. And do you consider that a pessimistic film or a parody? Or a
well, I'm not exactly sure what it turned out to be. I was playing it straight. In the beginning, of course, as you know, it is a tremendously long book. Just in terms of plot, trying to fit all this into the arbitrary length of a 2-hour film. It is a very discursive plot. It's two stories, and one of them takes place really during World War II, and then the part that we're concerned with now takes place now, but it hooks back onto the World War II story. In other words, as I recall it, you start out with one modern day plot of Marlowe and Terry, and then that breaks, and then you go on to the rest of it, and then you find where the two link up. Okay, The Big Sleep started off with a bang, and it never quit moving. Never sat down to talk. There was an awful lot of good dialogue, but it didn't talk, if you know what I mean. Marlowe's introspective thoughts were easily put into a line of dialogue to somebody. In The Long Goodbye, there were chapters and chapters and chapters of Marlowe thinking how rotten the world was and how rotten everybody in it was. By this time, Chandler, of course, had got older, and he was going through a very cruel phase in his own life. His wife was dying, and he was an unhappy man. And the whole world, I can imagine, might have seemed very sour, you know, and bad to him. So there was relatively little or no action in the book, and so many of the things 25 years later that were fresh when The Big Sleep was fresh, you can't do them anymore. You know, they've just become such cliches that they're funny. So we had that problem. Then we had the problem of what period to do it in. Shall we go back and do it in the 50s, or shall we bring it up to date? Well, if you go back and do it in the 50s, that's just dandy, but it runs your budget way up. If you bring it up to date, you're getting your people a little bit into the geriatric set, you know, if you hang on to that World War II business. We tried it with the Korean War. It didn't work. The mood was all wrong. The whole thing was all wrong. So what to do?
And when you say we, who do you mean?
Well, I was working with Jerry Bick in the beginning, and Elliot Kastner, of course, was the executive producer, but Jerry was the producer, and Hutton, Brian Hutton, who was to be the director. Brian Hutton was...
Oh, he was?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And Brian was having problems himself at that time. And Brian got a brilliant idea how to solve the plot problem. And I kept telling him, I don't think it'll work because I think, you know, and then I'd say, why I didn't think, but Brian doesn't understand the discipline and the structure of the mystery story, which is a thing you have to...
Of any story.
Well, but the mystery story, the detective story, the mystery story especially, it's like putting a watch together. And if one piece doesn't fit, the whole watch doesn't work. And his brilliant idea was very clever. The only trouble was it killed you right at the top of page one. You were dead all over, you know, right there. Well, I thought maybe I'm wrong, so I'll go ahead and do it. So I wrote the script. And it didn't work.
What was his brilliant idea?
Well, Terry had... We threw out quite a few of the characters. And we started off with Terry and the death of Sylvia. And his idea was that Terry had pre-planned the whole thing. And he'd gotten, what had he done? He'd murdered the wife, he murdered his wife himself, knowing that Roger Wade would be blamed for it. And, you know, and in other words, you had people coming out of boxes and saying words because they had to, otherwise the plot didn't work. And a plot that's built that way never works. Just, you know, you've just got puppets, mm-hmm. and nothing builds. So I sent it in. I didn't like it very much, and I had done something with the ending. I've forgotten because the ending in the book was inconclusive, everybody felt, and I did something. And Brian said, no, hell, I'd rather have Marlowe shoot himself. So I said, well, fine, that at least I do like, so let's have Marlowe shoot him. So that's where that came from. Well, then there was a hiatus some problem, but had nothing to do with me. I don't know, way up at the production top. And Brian had another commitment and had to leave the film. So there we sat for quite a while on the shelf. And so then they got Bob Altman. And Bob Altman was cutting images at that point. And he was in London, so I scooted over to London again, where I'd gone to see Brian, to talk with Brian and Jerry Bick, which was no sweat. I go to London any time, with or without expense account. And Altman had, because I had written Jerry and Elliot Kastner a letter saying what I felt was wrong with the structure of the script and how I felt we could fix it. And Altman said, the most hopeful thing I see about this is that letter you wrote. And so we started from there on a very good basis. And we had jam sessions, he and Jerry Bick and I, every day for a week and got it all thrashed out. I'd go home to the hotel at night and pound on the borrowed typewriter until I got all, you know, the notes all bound, and then go back the next day and do the next segment. And we got everything all thrashed out, and then I came home and did the script, and that was that. And some of the touches, like the cat, the opening with the cat, were Bob's, and the ending,
where he dances up
away to that was Altman's. And I, the first time I saw that in the projection room, I looked at it and I, what in the, phew, you know, is going on here? And oh well, he said, you know, the whole thing is a farce. You know, you can't play it straight. Everybody knows it's you play it off as a joke. And I said, well, maybe you know what you're doing. And he said, well, we'll just, you know, run it that way and see what the audience thinks of it, and then we can always pull it. And but I guess they didn't, because it was still on the print that I saw in the theater.
No, they didn't.
A couple of connective tissue scenes got lost that were shot, that were made things a little confusing, like how Eileen got hold of the money that she gave back to the gambler, which was shown, which was written in the script and photographed but didn't get on the screen. A couple of things like that. Now, there again is what I mean. The connective tissue, the whodunit and why. All directors, Howard Hawks, Altman, everyone I've ever worked with, have an absolute loathing, and I can perfectly well understand why, for scenes where actors stand and talk plot at each other. And you remember in the early days of the the talkies, they do these very complicated murder mysteries, and the detective would say, and then I knew, you know, because so-and-so was hiding in the closet and all that stuff, you know, and you'd go to sleep on it. So I can understand why they shy away from these scenes. So I get it down, you know, where it's like two lines, you know, and I think, well, maybe they won't even notice those lines are in there, you know, because they sound quite natural, they're embedded in the dialogue. They get lost. They're not there. You know, that's a little frustrating, but...
So they get taken out anyway.
That's right.
It seems to me like there was a big problem. If you played it, if you thought of it as a straight work and he thought of it as a joke, did you ever come to his way of thinking?
Well, I didn't have any... I wasn't around when he was shooting it. And when we worked together, we were working on the characters and the structure. And, you know, everything ran right along. And actually, the satiric touches that he put in didn't have anything to do with the structure or the basic characters.
Isn't Marlowe played as a kind of a... Almost, well, he is a fool in some ways. Isn't
well, he's an innocent man. He's a decent man. He's an honest man. He's the honest man who always gets screwed because he believes everybody else is honest, and he trusts his friends. And he got taken for a ride, and he got mad.
Did you get a lot of letters that said you some way betrayed Chandler?
I didn't get so many letters, but I got a couple. Well, Charles Champlin in the L.A. Times just practically had a frothing fit about it. And we knew we were going to get flack. We knew we were. especially on the on Marlowe killing Terry, because this was out of character for Marlowe. But it was out of character for the time when Marlowe was written. You couldn't do that on the screen. No matter how right it might have been, you couldn't do that. As, you know, if you remember, he always had to sucker somebody else into doing the shooting. You know, he'd get somebody to walk out a door knowing that somebody was out there ready to kill him, and he'd get somebody else to walk out. You could do that, but you couldn't do it bang. And I thought it was, you know, here is a decent man who has trusted a friend and done him a favor and gotten himself, you know, gotten his neck in the grease. He's fallen in love with a woman who didn't even know he was alive. She didn't really betray him. She didn't even know he was there. Everything. And he said, I lost everything. I even lost my cat. You know, and he said, you're just not going to get away with it. Just, you know, yeah. Which I thought, which satisfied me.
Right.
A lot of people thought we had taken undue liberties, you know, with the thing, because it wasn't right in the, you know, in the, it wasn't the big sleep over again.
Not only that, it was totally different from Chandler's style, wasn't it? With this opaqueness and this
blankness. You're not going to get Altman to do, no. You know, it's going to be an Altman film.
You were willing to do that.
Yeah, sure. Elliot Gould. Now, Elliot Gould came with the film, with the deal, because United Artists had a commitment with him, so he was Marlowe, or we didn't make the film, mm-hmm. Which also posed you another problem, because I like Elliot Gould. I think Elliot Gould is one hell of an actor, but he is not Humphrey Bogart, and nothing under the sun you were going to do with him is going to make him look like Humphrey Bogart or act like him. And so you had to kind of do a whole new character. Mm-hmm. And, you know, which was the mumbling and the... we tried to keep as much as we could, but, you know, with the businesses, with the cops and so on. We tried to keep as much as we could of either the original Chandler or what we thought Chandler might have done if he had been writing it now.
But there's a lot of risk in that.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of risk. The picture died, you know, on the West Coast. It came out and it got one beautiful review in the Reporter, which I framed. And the rest was all either screams of fury or, you know. So when it opened in New York, I was just sitting there with my fingers crossed, waiting for the roof to fall in. My little niece, who lives up there, is a musician, rang me up on the phone and said, Natalie, I've just read the reviews, you know, I just got the New York Times. And she said, listen, you know, and she started to read me, and I almost fainted. I said, are you sure you're, you know, and the reviews were all marvelous.
And so you, of course, read Pauline Kael's.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yes, us venerable pulp writers. Most of that improvised dialogue, two-thirds of it came right out of my typewriter. And I don't know whether she thought the whole structure and the whole shape and the structure and the progression of the scenes and everything was just kind of, you know, fell out of the sky onto the set. But anyhow...
Well, probably Altman let her think that a lot of it was improvised.
A lot of it, he did improvise a good bit on the set. That scene, I must tell you that the scene with the Coke bottle was not in the script. I don't think the gangster even had a girlfriend mm-hmm. in the script. Somebody wrote to me, Mike, take one.
Mike Goodwin,
take one. He said, what about that scene there? He said, that hard Coke bottle, said those mothers are hard, you could build bridges with them, hit that soft face, and it shattered. And he said, that just didn't seem right to me. And I wrote back and I said, didn't seem right to me either. I said, it was a shocker of a scene, you know, brought me up in my seat. But I thought the same thing, yeah. You know. The face is going to go splat, but that Coke bottle is not going to be hurt in the slightest. Anyhow, and the business of, you know, let the end, the guy say, everybody take your clothes off. That was not in the scene, in the script. And some of the dialogue between, you see, Dan Blocker, originally was to have played, and he died just before they started shooting. So,
when Wade walks off into the ocean, a beautiful scene.
That was a beautiful scene.
Was that in the script, or Altman?
The suicide itself was in the script.
But the way
but
it was filmed,
it was.
I'll give you a book to look.
It was in the. It was the way it was done in the book. I mean, you know, behind the closed door and the bang, and the guy blows his head off. Of course, I didn't know at the time we were going to have the Malibu set, or I might have thought of it. I don't say I would have thought of it, but I might have thought of it. But it was pure Altman, and it was purely magnificent. It was absolutely beautiful, just superb. But in those scenes between Marlowe and Roger, I tried to build up the fact that Marlowe was suicidal, and that he was sadistically punishing his wife, you know, taking everything out on her, and that he was suicidal as well as alcoholic. Mm-hmm. And some of the, of course, he doesn't speak the same language that Dan Blocker spoke. You know, the rhythm, everything was all different. So a lot of the dialogue got changed just out of necessity. And Altman, I saw the full rough cut, and he put Gould and Hayden down in those chairs on the beach and just let them say whatever came into their heads. And part of it was fascinating, but it went on far too long, I thought. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, it was muchly cut in the theater print. But I could have wished some of the scenes were a little tighter. Now, that there was one beautiful scene between Hayden and his wife, which was done behind the window.
And a lot of people complained about that.
They did. I thought it was beautiful, and that was all.
Because they said we should hear what they are saying. We shouldn't be prevented from... Chandler would never have prevented us from knowing what's going on.
No, that's true. Probably true, but I thought it was fine, and that was Altman's entirely.
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful film. I like it. Goodbye, My Lovely is starring Robert Mitchum.
Yes,
do you think that's good casting, or...?
I think Mitchum, Mitchum's a hell of a good actor. And I think he could do a very good Marlowe. I could visualize it, yes. Mm-hmm.
There's always been a question that No, let me start over again. In The Big Sleep, I don't know what, I guess it was Fox who said this, or apocryphally said it. He doesn't even know who killed one of the people. No,
that's not apocryphal at all.
That's true.
Yep.
There's a murder that occurs.
Yeah.
No,
there's a character in the book named Owen Taylor, who was the chauffeur. And Owen Taylor is fished out of, as I recall it, Santa Monica Bay in the car. And I believe that's the right character. And I was down on the set one day, and Bogey came up and he said, do you know who killed Owen Taylor? And I said, no. So they called back up to the office to get a hold of Faulkner, and I said, Bill, do you know who killed Owen Taylor? And he said, no, I don't know. So Bogey said, well, let's send Chandler a wire and find out from him. He ought to know. So they did. Wire came back, I don't know. And you look all through the book and you can't find out who killed him. because we all did.
That's funny. How much of that film did you... You've got a co-scripting credit now.
Yeah.
How much did you work on that film?
The day I checked into work, and I was greener than grass, and here I am faced with William Faulkner.
Right.
How in the world am I going to work with this man, you know? I needn't have worried, because Faulkner, who was most punctiliously polite, you know, the southern gentleman to his fingertips, greeted me when I came in, handed me a copy of the book. He said, "We will do thus." He said, "We will do alternate chapters. I will do these, you will do those. I will do these, you will do those. Goodbye." And I don't think I ever saw him again except to say good morning. And so I did the alternate chapters, which had been assigned unto me, and gave them to Howard Hawks. And I never saw what Faulkner wrote, and he never saw what I wrote. And Hawks was off playing golf or shooting Clark Gable and some, you know, most of the time. He's never around during the preparatory stages. He just turns his writers loose and lets them work. And I've seen strong men driven to drink and tears because they need somebody to talk to, and there isn't anybody there. And every once in a while, one of them would come in and ask me, I was working on something, and the very nice man, one of the nicest men I know, and a hell of a good writer. He was a Saturday Evening Post writer, one of their top writers. But this particular way of doing things was, he said, "What does he want?" I said, "He wants pages." He said, "He's giving you the idea, the general outline of a story, the kind of a story that he wants, and just sit down and write pages. Anything that comes into your head, give him, you know, stacks of them. That's what he wants, his ideas, his pages." All right, you know, and then he'd, but he was terribly unhappy. Like, of course, the first time I worked for Hawks, I'd never worked for anybody before. And I was used to working all by myself, you know, in my own office with the door shut. And nothing appeared strange to me about it, and Faulkner was doing it. Of course, he'd worked with Hawks before, and he knew the way he worked, so it didn't bother me in the slightest. I just went ahead and did, and I guess that's one reason I was able to get along with
and
him
how much
so long.
How much of what you did appears in the, which you estimate appears in the
I
version?
Would appear about, would imagine that about, I don't think, very much of Faulkner's dialogue actually got on the screen. He was famous, I was told, as a writer who had written X number of films but never had a line of dialogue on the screen. And I know Fogey came up to me one day on the set and he said, "Did you write this?" And I said, "Uh-uh." He said, "I didn't think so." And Faulkner wrote Faulkner dialogue, you know, with all those subjunctive clauses and so on, and no actor born a woman could get his tongue around all of them and make them come out, you know. And so I did not rewrite a line of it myself, but I'm sure that Bogart and Hawks, and Hawks did a lot of rewriting himself on the set, rewrote a good bit of the dialogue. Faulkner was a whizzer on construction, but we stuck very close to the book. And Hawks, of course, improvises a great deal in his scenes. He gets a good thing going and, you know, gets something going between two people, and those are all some of the best scenes in the films, the ones that weren't in the script. About two-thirds of the way through, because he does do this, he shoots off the cuff, he realized that he was getting far more film piled up in the cans than he was going to have time for, you know, to do the rest of the script. So he called in Jules Furthman to rewrite and shorten the ending. So I'd say it was about a third each.
Mm-hmm. Maybe some of Faulkner's dialogue got in and landed the Pharaohs.
Well, if it did, it sounded right to me. Now, this is one thing that Hawks and I was going to say have quarreled fiercely on. Actually, we haven't quarreled at all on it, but I always disagreed with him furiously. He hates the Land of the Pharaohs, absolutely hates it with a passion. And I said, "You're crazy, Howard. It's one of the greatest films you ever made."
Well, that's interesting. Why would you say that?
Well, because it was. In the first place, it showed a tremendous imagination even to think of doing it. He went to a great deal of trouble to get the feel of the country, of the people, of the mentalities of the ancient Egyptians. As I say, we're ancient history buffs, and we've seen that film a half a dozen times, and it captured for us better than any other film we've seen the feeling of the country and of the people as it must have been at that time.
Can a film that has Joan Collins and Dewey Martin in major parts?
I could have done. She was a pill, and I could have done without him, and I could have done without James Robertson Justice, and there were, you know, some other things I could have done without. And I told Jules Furthman later. I said, you know, that opening sequence was magnificent. You know, with the Pharaoh coming in and the, you remember the procession and all that. I said, the only trouble was, didn't any of you know there were no camels in Egypt in the 4th dynasty? He said, what? Huh? No camels? Well, there were always camels in Egypt. I said, no. He said, well, what the hell did they use then? I said, there were little things called wild asses they used. And I don't think they didn't even have horses then. Not till after the Hyksos.
But the wild asses that they had.
Yeah, the onagers.
Onagers.
But I said, I didn't give a damn because you the camels looked right, and most people don't know it anyway. So who cares? You know, it was splendid, but...
Some picture they were working on, Mr. Hawks, when she complained that this was not according to history, he said, nobody will ever know this unless you go along with the picture at every show and tell them.
That's true.
And I love that ending where they... shut them all up in the tomb. Now that was pure comic book technique. Those great blocks coming down on the sand. You know, the bottles crashing, the sand pouring out, more blocks coming down. It was just beautiful. I love that film. I don't care whether he didn't like it or not.
And another question about that film, and I'm spellbound. I seen it recently. I'll have to go back and see it again. You wrote part of, I always get the title wrong, Grundy Mary, or Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry, or...
I wrote a version of it. He bought a novel by Unekis called Pursuit. And he had a script done by a young man, and I don't remember whether I ever read the script or not, whether he ever gave it to me. But... he wasn't happy with the script that he had. I think this was the kid's first crack at it. So I did a version, sticking very close to the original, of the thing with a girl, which he threw into. I don't think there was a girl in the original. It doesn't seem to me that there was, but he always wants a girl. Well, for obvious reasons, there has to be a girl in it. So he wanted kind of a crazy, nutty girl in it. So I put on a crazy, nutty girl and wrote the thing very much as it was. As you remember, the original took place out here in Illinois in the high corn season on that checkerboard of roads.
Did it?
Yeah. It was, you know, just below Chicago. South of Chicago. You know, where the roads are all laid out in squares, just like a checkerboard.
Mm-hmm.
Dirt roads. And the corn is, you know, 10 feet high. And this was the point of the whole thing, the getaway. You know, they'd hold up the market, and then they would down this road and that road and the other road, you know, and the whole thing was a chase. And the assistant director was, the producer was saying, you know who's going to have to go and do that in the middle of July and August and all that dust and so on and so forth. And so that's the way I wrote it. And then I get from the guild, this dirty Mary, Crazy Larry, whatever the thing was, by Lee Chapman. And I read it, and it sounded awfully familiar, except the girl had been changed again, And we had some bikers and hippies, and of course the whole thing had been shifted out to the West Coast. But I didn't have a copy of the book anymore, and I didn't have a copy of the script which I had sent down to the University of Eastern New Mexico, U. And I thought, what the hell? Anyway, so I said, I don't know. This sounds familiar, a lot of it, you know. But we all took from the same original, so I can't say, you know, who's entitled to what. There was another writer as well involved. So it came out that the Lee Chapman got the part of the credit, and the fellow who did the original script got the other, which is guild policy. Now, the writer who does the first script, almost automatically, if there's anything of his left, gets credit, which is really only fair enough. So I felt we all took from the same source, so it didn't really make too much difference.
Do you think to an aficionado your dialogue is recognizable?
Well, I don't know that it would be, because I try to write for the character and what the character would say, and not what I would, you know. I'm not writing me. I'm writing, in other words, when I'm writing for Humphrey Bogart, I wouldn't write the same way I'd write for John Wayne. It helps very much to know an actor's style when you are writing for him, because you can write, you know, the kind of dialogue that he can handle nicely, or that suits him. I mean,
turn it on a little cool.
I wondered what that was. Yeah, we could use it.
If I was to say that you are a cult heroine or something, what would your reaction be?
Oh, I don't think so.
You don't think so?
No, I don't think so.
Don't you think there's a small but insistent following that thinks
I'm amazed at the number of people who know my work. I really am. And I think part of it is simply that I've been around so long. I started out in 1944, and I've been fortunate enough to be associated with some very large important people and some large important films, so that I've just been lucky, I think, you know, that my name has become known through association with you know, just, well, do enough films like Rio Bravo and Hatari, and I just was lucky to get the assignments and lucky to be able to work with these people.
When you did those films and Big Sleep, did you know, you can't know, of course, but did you have a feeling that they might be lasting films?
Well, you always hope they will be. At least everything I do, I hope, is going to, you know, send up skyrockets and get Oscars and be showered with everything. Otherwise, I wouldn't. You have to feel that way, or you don't put your best into it. If you, we have known some writers, in other fields, who would say, "Well, I needed $100, so I did this piece of garbage." And it's no way to do. We have needed $100, and we have done stories that we would not particularly have chosen to do, because we needed the $100 very badly. But we have never done any story that we didn't put our best into, and that we didn't work at until we got a story that we liked and enjoyed doing. So I've always done that, no matter how insignificant I might think the film was going to be. I mean, like The Crime Doctor, I know this is not going to win any Academy Awards, but I did the damnedest best script for it that I could possibly do. I liked the characters, and I had a nice puzzle and a nice plot, and I enjoyed doing it, and I did the best I could.
How come, now, is it Eric John Stark? I always
miss
it. Okay.
Yes.
How come he has never been made into a film?
Well, how come Conan's never been made into a film? They're hard to do. They're very expensive to do. If you do them well, if you don't do them well, don't do them. My stuff, none of my science fiction stuff, and I wish that somebody would buy The Long Tomorrow and make it, because that is good science fiction, it's a good story, and it wouldn't cost $1 million. But most of my stuff has been interstellar or interplanetary and requires a lot of exotic cities and strange beasts, and I've never had any green giant men with four arms, I don't think, but things that they would just cost one whale of a lot of money.
Did you ever come close to having an original novel made into a film?
Oh, I've, as a matter of fact, I've had two made into films.
You have?
Oh, yeah. One was called The Tiger Among Us, which had a long, sad history of everything falling out from under it, and Alan Ladd Productions picked it up at Columbia and made it, and unfortunately made a very, very dull, poor film out of it called 13 West Street. Mm-hmm. And another one I wrote called An Eye for an Eye was bought by, for television, and was the original pilot for Markham. They took my detective out and wrote their own, put their own in.
I've noticed your name on the on Archer and Rockford Files recently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had one on Archer, which I pride myself was the one that came on after they canceled it, so...
What happened there?
I think, if you want my honest opinion, I think Brian Keith was a poor choice. He didn't seem to be terribly interested, he didn't seem to be trying very hard, he wasn't... didn't impart any life to the character, and I just think he was a poor choice.
Now, can one write for Jim Garner or not?
That is a very tricky show, and something happened there that I didn't like at all, and I know it wasn't their fault. I'm not blaming the people who were all grand to me, but they got into a terrible bind because they got into script trouble. And they needed the script in a rush, and they rang me up one more, or I rang them up, and because they'd been calling me every other day, when can they have it, and I said, I've just finished the script, and this was on a Friday, and I said, I'll copy it over the weekend, bring it down to you Monday, you know, do the polish, and this was the first draft script, you understand, and when I say polish, I don't mean the formal polish, but I mean my own polish as I go through. And they said, oh no, just bring the whole thing down, just as it is. And I said, my God, that part of it isn't even legible. You know, it's just all scribbled next and, never mind, we'll clear all that up. So I said, well, all right, if that's the way you want it, I don't like doing this, but... So I sat down and went through it and retyped a couple of pages that even I couldn't decipher and took it down to them, and I said, here it is. Now, this is the first time in my life I've ever turned in my rough. And I said, I don't know how good it is or anything, but here you are. So, thank you. You saved our lives. So they rang me up the next part of the week. They said that we'll read it right away and get back to you. And I said, no, you know, and I'll do the changes, whatever changes you want, just as fast as I can. And so they rang me back and they said that all it needs is just a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and it's the little touches on the Rockford character, which are hard for an outsider, you know, who's not done, and we can do them easier right here in the office. So thanks very much. So I end up with the story editor as a collaborator, because she did the polish on the thing, which is okay. For instance, the character Angel, which was becoming at that point, which they had decided at that point to make a running character, hadn't been in before, and he was not in my script. I just had a character. So they wrote Angel into it, which is fine. And changed the ending, you know, the physical part of the ending, and some other stuff, and some byplay, and so on. So, You know, and I'm not complaining about that. They were in a bind, and I understand how this is. You know, you've got a deadline to meet, and you've got to meet it. And I think now the thing is all being staff written. The last thing I got from the guild, they were almost experimenting with outside writers.
You aren't this tolerant when you're in a business discussion, are you? Because it would seem like if you have said how much your stuff means to you, you have to fight for it, don't you?
Yeah, except that under certain circumstances, when you're doing a job like that, you don't have the control over it that you have over your own. I mean, a book is another matter, but a motion picture or a television script is a team thing, and they have necessities over which they have no control. Have production necessities that over which they have no control, and over with which you can't quarrel. And I've always bent over backwards. I mean, I've never seen any reason to go off like a skyrocket because somebody changes a line to, you know, like it rained yesterday to it didn't rain yesterday or something like that. You know, it isn't, this to me is just egotism.
When have you ever had your name removed from the script?
No.
You've never had your name removed?
No.
I thought we had a story there and we don't. One more question at least. What's your method? You were talking about rough drafts, and so many people think that you can write first draft, and of course one cannot. What is your method of composition generally?
Well, I have once or twice when the lightning has struck, written a thing first draft and made like two or three changes with a pen, and you know, and it was all just dandy. I think that's happened two or three times in my life. Mostly, I write a first draft, and I go over it very carefully, and I throw it out, and I do it over again. And I go off on wrong tangents, and oftentimes, you know, on a long novel, you'll get interrupted by something, and it's hard to pick it up again. You know, and then you realize that you got off on the wrong foot back here on page 70. I write a first draft, mm-hmm. and then I do a very careful polish on it.
When you say careful polish, how long would this take you?
Well, I go through and awkward bits of dialogue or things that don't belong there, or things that are overwritten. I mean, scenes that are too long. And like, you'll have a page of stuff from somebody that should be boiled down to half a page or a quarter of a page. After it's, you know, it's sat, or you've been away from it for a while, you can look back at it.
You can go back to it.
Yeah,
with a little
different perspective.
I can't. No, I have to finish it and do my polishing then, because if I go back, I ruin it.
Well, I prefer to do mine immediately, but I mean, if I get like I was, you know, in the hospital for a month. I'm coming back to it now, and I see things that I did wrong in the chapters I did just before I went in. And I'm now picking those up and say, oh boy, this is the way I've got to go, you know, and I'm really beginning to pick up speed again.
Do the things stay in your mind until you solve the problem? I mean, do they
yeah.
stay with you all
mm-hmm.
the time?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I would think so. What was your reaction to Howard Hawks making El Dorado? Did you think that was a mistake, or that was a...
It broke my heart. I wrote the best script I think I've ever written for El Dorado, and I sent it in to him, and he loved it, and John Wayne loved it, and the studio loved it, and we didn't make it.
I liked it too.
I don't know. I don't like doing things over again. And I wished that, you know, there was a little too much of Rio Bravo in El Dorado. mm-hmm. as I don't have
by
to tell
Hawks
you.
By Hawks' Choice.
Yeah. And I tried to, to write the scenes that I had written before as though I had not written them before. In other words, to try and do them a different way. But I know when I'm outgunned, because I was in Howard's office with Duke. And he said, I have a scene where, ba 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 ba, you know. And I said, Howard, you did that in Rio Bravo. And I said, I'm not going to write that scene over again. And he looked at me, and Duke, you know, from way up here, looks down and he says, why not? If it was good once, it'll be just as good again. So I said, all right.
So you can't salvage
and
any
I
of
did it.
You can't salvage any of the original?
Someday I will, maybe.
Have you done that before? Have you salvaged something that...
No, because when you write a thing, you know, you write it for the studio, and the material does not belong to you, it belongs to the studio. This mm-hmm. is made quite clear. Anything you do for them belongs to them. In other words, they could take that original script and I suppose Hawk, actually it all belongs to Hawks and he probably still has it, but they could make that and it would be perfectly legal.
Last question, because I'm running out of questions. This is kind of a I shouldn't have driven for 5 hours this morning, but having the name Lee Brackett and obviously that fooled some people into thinking you were masculine. That helped you, that hurt you, or that it was no factor?
I don't think it made much difference. A lot of people used to figure that I made the name up, you know, just because it was kind of unusual and striking and... In fact, I used to, I've had a few people sort of sneer at me. And it's on my birth certificate. Lee is a family name, should be pronounced Lay, but that was an unfortunate pronunciation around the studio, so I dropped it. And besides, nobody knows how to spell it. Then I go to England and I say my name is Lee, spelled L-E-I-G-H, and they stare at me and say, what? But anyway, it was my mother's middle name. And I was christened Lee Brackett.
And
she
that is what you were
to a good reputation for herself before we were married, and so she just naturally continued to use her maiden name as a professional name. Mm-hmm.
But I would imagine that half the mail you get is to Mr.
Oh, I get a lot
Lee
addressed
Brackett,
to Mr., yes. Although most of it comes either, most people know now.
Mm-hmm.
But I used to get a lot of it addressed to Mr.
That's terrific. I really...